The life of Antony is one of the richest sources to which we can turn for models of what it meant to consecrate one's life to God. It was a profoundly influential book. It is probably one of the lives of the fathers that Saint Benedict intends that his monks and nuns should read daily. So there is a very ancient tradition of using this book as a source of information on early monasticism, but its author, Saint Athanasius, was also not only defending the monastic tradition and setting it up as a model for holiness. If we read this text carefully, we'll also see that he's presenting a model of a close interrelationship between monastic life and parish life, between the local Christian community and the monastic community, or the monastic solitary symbolized by Antony, and he presents it as a very thriving relationship, one in which each is enhanced by the other. And that's how I would like us to read this text or to look at it. I haven't included very much commentary except some large gray boxes which include the principal points that I'd like to especially highlight, and I'd invite you to read over these two sections that I have presented here in this course section from the perspective of looking at the sources of Antony's holiness, especially here in this early source. You may be amazed to find this early section that Antony's principal source of holiness is not his solitary experience of God, but it is the living examples of holiness which he finds in his parish community. Athanasius is describing Antony's first stage of monastic life as consisting in careful attention to the spirituality of the local Christian community. That's where he learns what it is to be holy. So, looking at the text itself, from the prologue, I've abbreviated it somewhat, but included particularly in the second paragraph, Athanasius' very clear statement that he intends that the life of Antony be seen as a fitting pattern, that Antony's life, his bios, be a charakter, that it be a fitting example for monks to live according to. But it's also a life that contains images of holiness that can be lived out by lay people as well. I might mention parenthetically that the popularity of this work in the ancient world is almost impossible to imagine. Within a few years of its publication in Greek, it had been translated into Latin and was available at the outermost reaches of the empire. We know from St. Augustine's Confessions that he knew someone who had been converted, who had had a real experience of intensification of life by reading this life of Antony in Latin while he was in the army, not Augustine himself, again someone else he knew, and this took place in Trier, Germany, at the very outposts of civilization. So within a few decades of its publication, this work was destined to know tremendous popularity and to be read by many, many people, encouraging many to follow Antony's example, this pattern of ascetical living, and follow Antony into the desert. The rather cynical and anti-monastic historian Gibbon describes it as one of the most pernicious books because of its powerful influence. It caused so many people to give up Roman civic life and to undertake life in the desert that Gibbon actually considers it to be one of the forces that contributed to the fall of the Roman Empire, a kind of a backhanded compliment or backhanded acknowledgement of how popular and important this work was. So, dropping down to the section on youth and family, he comes from a fairly well-to-do family. They owned property, but Antony didn't pay much attention to schooling. This is the source of some controversy in our day. To be described as literate at this time, as knowing letters, generally meant that a person could write Greek. You might well be able to read Greek, but that wouldn't necessarily mean that you would be described as literate unless you could write as well. And so when Antony is described as illiterate, that has often in the past been interpreted to mean that he didn't know any Greek at all. That's probably a rather gross overstatement. Certainly we know from his letters that he had access to and familiarity with many of the schools of mystical theology and philosophical theology that were current in his day, particularly emanating from Alexandria, that he had either secondary or maybe even primary experience of the writings of Origen. But it's clear from this biography that he didn't care much for learning and certainly didn't learn to write Greek. If we drop down to the picture, which shows you the delta on one side and a Fayum mummy portrait on the other, these mummy portraits from the Fayum delta, which is shown in detail in the picture next to it, are a tremendous treasure trove because they give us access to a sense of what life was like, what people looked like in this area at this period. When Antony was retiring into the desert, this is what a young man who died during that period looked like. The Fayum itself is a semi-natural, semi-artificial oasis, which since very ancient times has captured the water that flows over from the Nile and created a kind of a reserve area of fertility that could even be used in times of drought. Antony probably grew up in the Fayum or around it, although his biography is not absolutely specific. We do know that when he retires to the fort, which will happen not in the section you're looking at now, but in what I've labeled part two of the life of Antony, we know that he moves to Pispir, which is right across the Nile from the Fayum oasis. Dropping down now a little further, and again, I'm not going to make any attempt to go over the story in detail, but just to note a couple of highlights. Note the strong emphasis on a kind of lectio divina, but which is a lectio based on reading. He listened to the texts being read. He was attentive and kept in his heart, dia te re, what was being profitable and what he heard. Antony heard the texts read out, particularly at church. This is what nourished his spiritual life, and it enabled him to memorize large portions of the scripture, which became the basis of his own spiritual practice. The next section down, chapter 2, I've given you the little gray heading. His call to asceticism happens through aural, through heard lectio divina. And as you read through this, notice that he decides to become a monk as a result of hearing the text read out in church, "If you would be perfect, go sell all that you have." He resolves to do this, and then later hears the text, "Do not have any concern for the morrow," in chapter 3, and that means he even gives away what he was going to keep for his sister, and he entrusts her to the care of these mysterious consecrated women, this community of virgins, indicating again that women had monastic life in the church long before men did, even if their history isn't written. He then undertakes a period of private asceticism, not too far from his own village, and as I go on to note in the section marked apprenticeship in asceticism, he becomes the apprentice of an abba, of an old man, of a zealous person who is already living this kind of life. So Antony is certainly not the first person. He is regarded as the first to have gone into the deep desert, into very remote solitude, but not the first to practice even private asceticism, and certainly not the first to consecrate himself in a celibate life to the service of God. He does manual labor, works together in relationship with the local community, and then again, aural lectio divina is mentioned just before chapter 4. He is attentive at the reading of the scripture lessons in church, so his memory serves him in place of books. Memorized scripture is a very important source of his spiritual growth. And the parish community. In chapter 4, we see, and it's described in detail, that he looks at the members of the parish for examples of holiness. It is here in relationship with the community, in, as it were, a relationship between his own private monastic growth and asceticism, his semi-solitude with his spiritual father, with his teacher, and using the life of and the experience of the parish community with its many rich models of holiness that Antony begins himself to grow in holiness. I'll leave you to read the remainder of this section on your own, including his struggles with the demons, a rather specific description towards the end of his ascetical practice, that's in chapter 7, where there are details about his dietary restrictions, his his avoiding of luxuries and his concern to live quite simply. And we'll continue in the next section with his real change and shift in monastic life and practice.